history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have stories to tell, and they won't call themselves that. They're too humble, and that's the case again today. But I think the rest of us, when we hear these stories, we're certainly struck by how much they love our country. We're going to meet quite a guy today. Each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, really inspired. The gentleman you're going to meet today has been educating folks for a long time in Hawaii at the USS Arizona Memorial. He makes appearances every year around the holidays. And maybe you've been out there if you visited the USS Arizona Memorial and seen some of those incredible sights. Maybe you've met this gentleman and shook his hand and heard some of his stories from Pearl Harbor. We're going to hear about that. We're going to hear why he cut off his finger to get in the Navy. And we're going to hear a whole lot more. Who knows what we're going to hear from 95-year-old Delton Wally Walling of Valley Springs, California. Valley Springs isn't all that big of a place. It's a pretty drive out here on Highway 26. But how big was your hometown of Belding, Michigan?
4,500.
That's a big city.
Big city in those days.
And you grew up in a big family.
12 kids, 6 girls and 6 boys.
And you were the youngest of that dozen.
And I was the youngest. So they ran out of names when they came to me. And the old Dutch lady that spanked me on the butt and started me on my life ran out of names.
Uh-huh.
So Delton, you don't hear. You might hear Elton or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard of Delton in my life.
Mm-hmm. I know one other. Maybe I'll give him your number so you guys can huddle up together. Not that common of a name. And not too common to be the youngest of 12 kids growing up during the Great Depression. What was that like for you? What do you remember about those days?
Hard work. From the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I was working, doing something to keep the farm going.
4 and 5 years old.
Yep.
So is that like milking cows, pulling weeds? What are you doing?
Milking cows and cleaning up the barn.
Dirty jobs.
Dirty jobs. Didn't realize at that time or think anything about it because that was a common way of life.
Sure. And you lost your father at a very young age.
Very young. I was 7 years old about that time. He was a farmer and he was also an educated merchant marine man.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for President Lines, so he traveled the world. We knew nothing about the world because he done all the traveling. And, of course, we had 12 kids. Every time I come home, I guess we're going to have another kid. Every time I come home, I guess we're going to have another kid.
That's how it worked. Good thing he was gone a little bit. Otherwise, there might have been 20.
Yeah, that's right.
What happened? How was he killed?
He was on a trip coming out of Hong Kong to go down to Manila, and he had a rupture in his intestines.
Mm.
And during his sleep, he went to bed, and he had a strangulation, hernia, and it killed him.
Wow. So for you, as a 7-year-old kid, no chance to say goodbye, just this stunning news.
That's it.
How did you deal with that at such a young age?
Well, I really don't know. I can't go back to how I was thinking at 7 years mm-hmm. of age. My brothers all passed away early. They were unlucky and got diphtheria and smallpox. In those days, you didn't have vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And they got it. So it killed 4 of them, so it left 2. My brother that was in the Philippines at the time that I was there, and me. He was my older brother right next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up only knowing that brother. And my sisters, all 3 of the 6, got polio. So
wow.
They were all crippled
Holy
sisters
smokes.
All their lives. But they made a wonderful life out of that by being able to set and do a job, like working for AT&T and bell telephone, stuff like that.
So you were dealing with tragedy from a very young age, and lo and behold, you would be witness to one of the most tragic days in American history that led, of course, to some of the greatest triumphs in American history, as we're going to touch on with your Pearl Harbor story. But still in your childhood, I know you got into boxing pretty early, and you were pretty good. Where did that come from?
Well, when my mother married again, and I went to live with them for a short period of time, it was in a country school, and a family of 12 boys out of one family ruled that little school.
I can imagine why.
And here I am, just a skinny little runt, and boy, they beat up on me all the time. So I was coming home, and my stepdad was seeing that, and he had been a policeman in the Grand Rapids Police Department, and he knew all the rough tactics. So one day, he called me Stubby. He said, Stubby, I'm going to teach you all the rough tactics of how to protect yourself. And when you go to school, when I get done with you, you better not come back without saying you took the biggest bully and put him down. And so 6 or 8 months later, he says, you're ready to go. You go to school today and you get that the meanest one there. And I want to see the results. I went to school and done just exactly what he said. That bully never bothered me again, and no one in that school, and from then on in life, has messed around with me too much, because I'll come loose.
And you got into competitive boxing. You even did the Golden Gloves.
Yeah. And then when I went in the Navy there at Pearl Harbor, I was boxing all the time at the Block Recreation Center there, and we fought every week, paid no attention to how many or what or who we fought.
Yeah,
it was just in the recreation. Then I went on out in the Pacific, and on my ship, I had a boxing group on my ship. Well, the record says 115 bouts and 198 or something like that. I don't even know how many I won.
And boxing works into your Navy story. And you mentioned your dad being in the Merchant Marines and sailing all over the world. Is that where your idea of getting in the Navy came from?
No. I could see the war is coming.
You read the newspapers, heard what Hitler was doing?
Well, you see, before the war started, we didn't even know where Japan was. There was a map, a globe map, and here's an island, and this is Japan. We didn't know the people. We didn't know their culture. We knew nothing. Then I can see Roosevelt has cut off their oil and gas and iron, and so they're backed up against the wall. They're going to go do something. They got to do something to keep themselves alive. And I could kind of read that in. So that's when I
That's when
graduated.
You decided to join the Navy?
And that's when I joined, because I don't like to dig a foxhole and lay with the snakes and stuff like that.
So you figured a war is coming, and I'm going to get in the Navy where I've got a bed to sleep on and good food and all that. But it wasn't that simple for you to get in the Navy.
No, I had to cut the finger off.
I got to get that story. Our listeners aren't going to believe this, and I've never met anybody else and all the hundreds of veterans I've talked to that have a story of getting into the service quite like this. So you and your buddy hitchhiked to Detroit.
Detroit, 180 miles.
And you could do that then. People would pick you up.
Oh, yeah. We got down there to the recruiting station, and they took my buddy. They stuffed him full of 5 bananas and got him heavy enough, and they took him. But when they came to me, I had that stiff finger sticking down straight. The doctor walked over to me.
And this finger is sticking down. This is from boxing. So you had broken two of your fingers, and your middle finger on your right hand
is sticking down straight.
So you couldn't shake someone's hand. That finger would get in the way.
That's right. But it wasn't bothering me as far as I'm concerned.
You're getting used to it. But the doctor looks at it, and what does he tell you?
He walks over, and he grabs hold of my hand, and he takes that finger and tries to bend it. And he put me right down on the deck.
It hurt that much.
That hurt bad. He said, you're 4F, go home. And I told him, wait a minute. I can lick the whole bunch of you guys at one time with my arm behind my back. What do I have to do to get in this great Navy? And he says, cut it off.
Cut it off.
I said, your expense or mine? He says, yours.
What were you thinking? Just like that, cut it off. You really didn't care.
I didn't care. I had to get in the Navy.
Wow.
So
he says, you have to cut it off and you have to pay for it.
I have to pay for it. So I had to make out a form because I don't want to cut this thing off and I can't get in the Navy. So he made it out. And I went down on the streets of Detroit and finally found a shingle up there that said surgeon. And I went in, and that old doctor was older than I am now.
And you're 95.
And I am 95. And he looked at me and he said, "You're nuts." And I said, "I know that, but I got to get in the Navy." So after a little haggling, finally he said, "Oh, I'll cut it off." And I said, "No, wait a minute. I only got $20 and I got 180 miles to hitchhike home. Can you leave me enough for a sandwich?" He thought a minute and he said, "Well, maybe." He cut it off and left me $3. So I'm in the Navy. I went home for 9 or 10 days and then reported right into the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
When I reported in the Great Lakes, because my dad had been in a merchant marine, somehow I got acquainted with Morse code. Mm-hmm. And it kind of fascinated me.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying that on my own. It paid off. Because when I got into Great Lakes, the chief was checking your records and stuff and found out that I knew the code. Mm-hmm. And we was very short in those days on communication people.
Right.
He said, "Let's go out. I want to see what you know." He made me an instructor. So I didn't have to march and all that stuff. I was an instructor in Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I graduated and reported to the Pennsylvania in Bremerton, Washington, as I walked aboard, the chief signalman on the Pennsylvania, he was there 30 years, and he was a tough old cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no discipline whatsoever. Didn't even know what it was.
Uh-oh.
So he had made a deal with Admiral Richardson that he could take anyone off the street and teach them more about communications than they could learn at sea. Richardson had nothing to lose because we don't have them. So he had nothing to lose. He made the deal with him. And as I started up the gangway, coming on, he's standing there, that old gravel voice, and he says, "Sailor, step out." And I thought, my God, I haven't even got aboard, and I've already done something.
You're in trouble.
I'm in trouble. So he picked out 15 more, and the next day, we found out what discipline was. Because if he gave you something to learn today, you better have it tomorrow, because he's going to be right, the admiral.
Sure. So this is a big battleship, the Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania is the flagship of the Pacific Fleet. And Richardson is the admiral at that time. I was only with him a short period of time.
And your job is going to be communications.
Communications.
So you do that through Morse code, through flags?
Flags.
Uh-huh. Semaphore.
See, all until the Marianas Turkey Shoot in the Pacific. All your maneuvering of the ships was done by flag.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't go to radio because the Japanese would know where we're at.
Right.
And we're undermanned.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot be in the same waters with the Japanese. Because at the start of the war, we only had 3 carriers. They had 10. They had 100, over 100 destroyers. Mm-hmm. And we had 50. And so on down through the fleet. So we didn't belong in the same waters with the Japanese. And Richardson knew that. Now, Roosevelt comes aboard, and he wants Richardson to take the fleet to Pearl Harbor. Richardson had, in 1936, when he was a rear admiral, he had pulled a mock attack on Pearl Harbor, and he knew it could be done with his little squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately he told Roosevelt, "I'm not taking the fleet to Pearl Harbor. I'm not going to put it in harm's way."
Wow.
Out he went. You have not heard of Admiral Richardson. There's been nothing said in the books or nothing about that great admiral.
But you were there with him.
And I was there with him.
And are you saying the president came aboard your ship to talk to him?
Yeah.
You were
right
there.
I was there.
And here comes FDR.
Yeah.
This is in 1940.
That's, Or 40. So he threw out. Now they got to pick a new admiral.
Right.
Admiral Kimmel was a very brilliant man. Him and Nimitz was next in the line to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Nimitz was on a special assignment in Washington, and he should have been your new admiral. But because he was on that special assignment, he was given to Kimmel. Now, Kimmel told Roosevelt the very same thing that Richardson did. "I don't want to put the fleet in harm's way, but I also don't want to lose my ranks."
Mm-hmm.
"So I will take the fleet and do the best I can to get it ready." And he did just that. He was a very efficient, tough admiral.
And you were around him.
and I was around him, and I was a tough little at that time. And when we went into his force, he had a little talk with us, and he said, I don't like tattoos. If anyone gets a tattoo, they're gone. Well, you're telling me something I don't like. So about 6 months later, five of us out of the gang, he can't fire all of us. We decided to go ashore and get tattoos.
Right.
We drew straws, and I become the first one to get the tattoo on my chest, two little birds. And when I crawled off from that table, all my buddies are gone. I'm the only one going back with a tattoo.
They suckered you, huh?
Suckered me. A couple of days later, he's not supposed to be aboard.
So you're sneaking back on the ship, and the admiral's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, I just come back off, but I'm trying to hide, see, I think. But this is Sunday, and he's not aboard. And so I'm out on the gun shield, in behind the gun shield, laid out there on the deck.
Working on your tan.
Sunning the scabs, you know.
Oh, trying to get that tattoo to heal up a little.
Yeah. And all at once, I got a kick in the butt. And I looked up, and there stands the old man. Stand up, sailor. I stood up. He said, so, you think you're going to get away from me because you got the tattoo, do you? And I said, sir, I never thought about it, but I had thought about it. And he stood there and looked at me a minute, and he said, I got news for you. You're going to be with me as long as I'm an admiral in this Navy. And some days are not going to be as good as others. And he was exactly right. And we got along wonderful after that. I become his personal signalman when we was traveling to different ships to inspect it. I traveled with him. And then when Nimitz took over later, I stayed right doing the same job. I traveled with Nimitz everywhere he went.
So you got a real interesting perspective on the big picture of the war, and you had an interesting physical perspective of what happened December 7th, because you had a bird's eye view that very few people had. But I'm interested, before we get into that Sunday morning, did you have any sense, while you're on Oahu, did you have any sense that war was that imminent, that something was about to happen?
The smaller serviceman, nothing leaked down to them very much. Mm-hmm. You might pick up something like a month before when Roosevelt got a hold of Short and Kimmel and said, set up installations, gunneries and stuff, but don't put it out in sight where the civilians can see it. Mm. How can you do that in Pearl Harbor? They're looking down right on you. So they did that.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear about that fateful Sunday morning at Pearl Harbor and the unique way that Wally Walling experienced it. You also might not believe who taught him how to surf. Plenty of photos up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.